Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I am glad you are joining us today. We have a fascinating program planned for today. Now, I would like to believe that you may always think it's fascinating, but there are some days that it's more so than others. But we're going to talk about how you can measure happiness. And we're going to do that in a way that that I believe for a lot of folks is a stretch of understanding, because we're going to look at it from a starting point of economics. Most economists would argue that the key to success and therefore happiness is obtained through material goods, the acquisition of wealth, the acquisition of property. In some cases, for lack of a better word, the sequestering of resources, but it doesn't have to be that way. The tiny remote kingdom of Bhutan, which is basically just up in the Himalayas, and not just, but that's where it's located. We can actually talk about its location in a little bit, has really begun to look at things and has taken a drastically different approach. Generally, the way that economists measure things now in most Western societies is they measure by what is referred to as gross domestic product. They're looking at measuring things basically based upon income, revenue, and Bhutan is doing something very different. They are looking at gross national happiness, and they believe that amassing material wealth does not necessarily lead to happiness, and I suspect they can do a very good job of explaining to us why that is, and it should not be hard to understand. They're really developing ways to look at their society as not a materially rewarded environment, but a spiritually rewarded environment that provides a level of happiness that is not measured or technically tied to acquisition of wealth. My guests today are Doreen Labarto, who is a designer with Earth Design International, and she is also my notes were juggled around here. She's a board member with an organization called the Ecologist. And along with her, she's in studio today, is on the phone, we have Kinga Tsaring. And he is a former member of the Parliament of the Kingdom of Bhutan. And he's the founder of the Institute of Happiness. And he is currently at Harvard and attending the Harvard Divinity School and looking at ways to really tie all this together. Now, his background is both in engineering, corporate management, and having been a member of parliament. And we're going to try and get an understanding of what in the world one can do to look at one's gross national happiness as a measure versus relying on gross domestic production or product as a measure. It really necessarily doesn't have to be that way. And these folks in Bhutan have found a wonderful way to help us understand that. Before we have Kinga enter the conversation, Doreen, the tie that we talked briefly, I've known you for a number of years. You've been on the program before. How in the world did this get tied into your professional and worldview? I mean, you're by trade a planning director and community development person, have worked on a lot of cities and counties in the Central Coast. How did Bhutan become part of your portfolio?
I was also a county planning commissioner under Shirley Bianchi. She appointed me, and so I find it fascinating. I went back to school after many years being out of school, went to Pepperdine, went through the law school to do dispute resolution, and I was fortunate enough to meet Kinga Tsaring at the law school, and we start talking about Bhutan, this wonderful country in the Himalayas, and they were about ready to prepare a new constitution. And I'll let Kinga talk about that. I believe it was about 2007. They had a monarchy at that time, and the king decided to turn over some of the powers to a democracy, and they now have a democratic monarchy, so they have a prime minister in addition to a king. And as part of their constitution, they have four pillars of that constitution. Gross national happiness is basically a primary foundation of their constitution. And last June, got back in contact with Kinga after he became a member of the parliament. He went back to Harvard. He stepped down from the parliament, went to Harvard. We got together in Los Angeles, and he invited me to come to Bhutan along with a group from Harvard and MIT. And we started talking about gross national happiness. And as I thought about how that tied into sustainability and land use and environmental, I thought, you know, this country was founded basically with the pursuit of happiness. If we look at the Declaration of Independence, one of the things we talk about is that we have a pursuit of happiness in this country. And our Constitution was based on pursuit of happiness. And I started thinking about that. And when I thought about land use and I thought about how we go after quality of life, isn't that what we're pursuing? When we think about quality of life, we're looking at what makes us feel good. We might not call it happiness, but it's basically what is happiness and what makes us feel good. And when we do land use planning or we do environmental planning, it's what is aesthetically pleasing. When we go out to public places, when we go to the ocean, isn't that part of what makes us feel good and for future generations? And so, in addition, we start talking about climate change issues, which they're on the forefront of. And I was at the 2015 COP21 Paris Agreement, and I was fortunate enough to participate in that. And so I'm very interested in climate change issues. And Bhutan is on the forefront. They're carbon negative, which means that they actually take more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere rather than adding to it. And they're the only country in the world that does it.
Yeah, we'll have to revisit that, because that's one of the things that jumped out at me in the information you provided, was the concept of being carbon negative in any environment. Kinga, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for your patience. I probably where we need to start with this is there an explanation for what about the culture of your country or the view of your country and your fellow citizens that brought this desire to look at things more from a happiness standpoint than a productivity standpoint, because society historically has looked at things, we judge too many things by productivity, but it seems to be an underlying theme in all societies. So where did this begin for you?
I think thanks, Fred, Doreen, for making this happen, and then also KCBX for this wonderful opportunity. To your question, Fred, I think for Bhutan, everything started way back in the early 70s. And that was a time when, if you can imagine, that somebody who is just 16 years old, trying to apply for basically for college applications and find out that all of a sudden your dad has passed away. So now you have this whole weight of the family on your shoulder, being the eldest son in the family. And, not only the family, but look at the weight of the community, or not only just the community, but the weight of the whole nation. So actually I'm talking about our fourth king, who was just 16 years old. And that's actually exactly what happened to him back in 1972. The third king tragically passed away. And so that was a time when the question was asked by a journalist at the international airport, asking him, so as a young king, now what are your plans for a small country like Bhutan? Economically, as you said, very difficult in the Himalayas and very remote. And that was the time when His Majesty sort of articulated saying that for us, actually it's not the gross domestic product and the economic development, but the well-being of the nation, the well-being of every citizen in the country. So that's how the whole thing started. And I mean, to me personally, this was a very profound vision from a leader at such a young age, just 16 years of age. And that has sort of started off the trajectory for Bhutan as a nation. How do we define ourselves, and how do we chart our course over the years? And then also, I think geopolitically, you have to look at the fact that we are situated between 1.5 billion population in the north, which is China, and then another 1.5 billion in the south, which is India. And with a population of just around 650,000, I would say that we are a little smaller than both of these guys. So anyway, yeah, so that's how it all started. And to me, I think in terms of the origin, the fourth king is the origin. And he has not only articulated, but I think prior to gifting us again with democracy, again, he's the only monarch who has done that, I think, so far in history, where he has given up his throne voluntarily and then handed back the power to democracy and to the people. So that's how the origin started. And I think if you look at the sort of the whole social and the cultural context in which our nation was has evolved, so we have been ruled as a theocracy for probably over last 400 years. And by the way, another factoid is that one of the very smallest and the most remote countries have never been colonized. So I think we are too far away. So we have been independent all along. So Buddhism is the predominant major religion with about 80% of the population, but we also have around 20% who are Hinduism, Christianity, and other religion as well. So now our democracy is completely secular, so we accommodate all religion as well. But I think to answer your question on some of the evolution of such a unique philosophy, I think not only His Majesty's vision, but the whole evolution in terms of being a Buddhist nation, in terms of being situated in a mountainous country where we are often referred, even from Tibet and India, as the land of the medicine and the land of the thunder dragon. So that pretty much gives you an idea of actually the geographical location, the flora and fauna, the mountains. And with the spread of Buddhism, I think the whole sort of life impact and influence that religion, especially being practiced in such one of the most difficult terrains in the world, harsh weather condition, and where the communities, I think they have to not only survive, but I think within the limited resources, really learn how to support each other and grow as a nation. And I think that led to subsequent progress in how we became one of the first countries to actually declare as a nation state back in 1648. And I think coincidentally, that was the time when I think the Treaty of Westphalia was signed in Europe as well, where the nation states were formed. So I think this probably, from my view, are some of the things that led to this development of the unique concept.
Okay. Well, let me preface my question with the fact that I realize, as I've mentioned to you before the program, that I tend sometimes to on behalf of the dialogue being somewhat cynical. I'm wondering, do your countrymen look at the ability to possibly export happiness to the rest of the world as a viable economic way to help build the country? I don't know what the uh-huh. world basis of your economy is. The basis of your internal economy is probably self-sufficient, but right, how the right. rest of the world sees you with regard to commerce may affect your ability to look at happiness mm-hmm. as an exportable commodity.
Right, right. Well, I think that's very exciting business model. And in fact, I think we had some offers from, I don't know exactly where, but people who wanted to bottle some happy air from Bhutan and take it to their country. I don't know how serious they were. But I think to your point, the kind of export that we're looking at as a commodity, I think that's not necessarily the way how we Bhutanese look at it because of, some simple reasons. In order to do that, I think one is we have to commodify happiness as an item that could be packaged, labeled, and exported. B, even if you are to export a commodity, you have to be good at that. You have to mass manufacture, mass produce. And C, as you rightly indicated, I think you export something so you can get some payment in return. And I think as far as Bhutan is concerned, on the happiness concept, all those three are not there. So number A, we feel that happiness is, of course, as you might agree as well, highly subjective, depends on community to community, culture to culture, and individual to individual, even within the same household family. Happiness to what it means to mom is not necessarily what it means to the father. So I think that, in terms of commodifying, to me personally, I don't see it's going to happen. B, are we really good in manufacturing happiness? Absolutely not. I think this whole label of happiness for Bhutan, in fact, has not been by our choice. I think the king had the vision, and the subjects and the small population in Bhutan, we were aligned with the vision and the goal, and that was something almost like calling in our life that we could relate to our religious in some way theological reflections and also how we define our identity in our situation. So for us, I think are we absolutely the happiest country in the world? Absolutely not. I think Bhutan, even though we're very small, with barely a million population, but we have the same challenges as would any big country with millions and millions of population has. Yep. We are multi-ethnic, we are multi-religion, we have our physical economic challenges. So we are absolutely not the happiest people in the world as well.
Okay. Let me jump in here for a second. I would have to say the following. I suspect if you're not the happiest country in the world, one of your obligations is to tell us where it is.
I
was suggesting that more as a long-term goal, not something you need to address right now.
No, Fred, I need to say this.
There are World Happiness Report and so many other compilations and surveys which are done, which invariably points to some of the Scandinavian countries who are supposed to be the happiest. Okay. And by the way, I just have to point out that for transparency purpose, in the World Happiness Report actually has ranked us as high as 97th. So we are hardly anywhere, not even on the top 10%. And that, I think, is another problem. I think the whole point for us is that we never wanted to be identified as the happiest nation. We never wanted to compete with anybody to be the happiest country. And we have our happiness measurement, which is of our own, depending on the cultural and the social background, and nothing to do with some of the modern metrics, which now people are, really coming up with. So I feel like, that's one of the reasons why we are not looking at exporting. That's one of the reasons why we are not actually, if people feel they can learn something from Bhutan, they are most welcome. We'll be very happy to open our doors and welcome them. But otherwise, I don't think we are in the position to go out and say, hey, look, we have figured out the secret of happiness.
Maybe part of this is what you're not saying to us, and we'll just accept that you don't want to talk about, is that you may be especially happy if people don't notice how happy you are, because then a lot of us will leave you alone. But with that, we have a caller on hold, and I don't want to keep them waiting too long. They've been very patient, so hold on a second.
Okay.
Catherine in Cambria, are you still there? Thank you for waiting.
Yes.
Okay. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my question. I feel that when one's health care is taken care of, it gives a person serenity, which I also feel is closely tied to happiness. Does Bhutan offer health care for its citizens?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, when you break it down in terms of the policy domain, so to answer your question directly, we do offer free health care and free education.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Thank you.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Was there any other question, Catherine, or that was it?
No, that was dear to my heart. So
okay.
I wanted to thank you very much.
Yeah.
Two points I need to make. When I came back from Bhutan in January, and somebody who was with us actually got ill when they were in Bhutan, and they were taken for medical service, and they weren't charged anything. They were an American, and they were charged nothing. The other thing I want to say, Fred, it's getting back to happiness. There are dogs that roam freely in Bhutan and other animals, and I've never seen so many dogs with smiles on their faces. So even the animals have smiles on their faces, and the people do too. They're just wonderful.
Okay, great. Okay, let me see. We have, hold on a second. Jeremy on the phone there. Are you with us, Jeremy? Hello? I don't get that call, so I'm not quite sure where they are. Okay, I need to drop that. Okay, sorry about that. Let me, you know, I need to remind folks, because I forgot at the beginning of the program, that you actually can call in. Now, luckily, some of our callers knew that without my remembering to give you the phone number, because it just slipped by me. I'm sorry. The phone number to call in is 805-781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. Doreen, can you, are you on the air with us still? Hello.
Okay, no, I just got disconnected in between, but now I'm back.
Okay, now you're back. Okay, thank you. Anyway, your tie into this project. I mean, it's I've known you as a planner. You've dealt with community planning. This is, I'm assuming, at some point when this was presented to you as a possible way of looking at community development, that was, I would say, startling, maybe startling in a very good way, but startling way to look at things.
I think it was an opportunity to start looking at things from a different perspective. I feel like in our process in the U.S., we're so fragmented when we look at planning and environmental issues. You know, we look at economics, we look at environmental, and I started looking at their constitution and going, wow, this makes sense. We talk about quality of life. And when we talk about quality of life, essentially that's what we're talking about. We're talking about what makes things work in a community, and it's balancing. It's economics. It's basically the environment. It's are people working, job, housing, balance. It's all of that. And when I look at what Bhutan's trying to do, it seems to me that's what they're presenting it. They don't call it quality of life. They call it happiness. But essentially, that's what we try to do. If we're doing sustainable planning and we're trying to build healthy communities, we're trying to really present happiness to the community. That's what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that most of our listeners know this, but my day job, I'm a volunteer here at the station, but my day job is I'm a travel advisor and a travel planner. And one of the things that's come up a lot in discussions in the last few years, but it's always been out there, is that a lot of the people who have the happiest life, the most contented life, the most rewarding level of well-being that they want to have are not people who acquire property. They're people who acquire experiences. You know, I think I've talked to a lot of people. If you look back at memories from 20 years in your past, sometimes the things that stick with you are not, oh, I had the opportunity to go to Iguazu Falls, and it was beautiful to see. It wasn't from a standpoint of, oh, I got to Iguazu Falls. It was the experience of what you did there. And it might have been something as simple as we sat on the patio of our hotel with some new friends that we had met and had breakfast on our last day there. And that's a memory that I've kept for 20 years versus whether or not I got to buy a new car last week. And I think as Homo sapiens, I think that's a factor that we're doing a better job of paying attention to again, not as good a job as I'd like us to do. But I'm wondering, you know, how, Kinga, how do you measure this?
Right. I think within Bhutan, we have the Center for Bhutan Studies. And then also our planning commission, equivalent to planning commission, is called the Gross National Happiness Commission. So the whole policy in terms of how we incorporate and trickle it down to the economic and development activities, and then how we monitor this is actually the entire happiness concept. Okay, we have the indices, we have the pillars, but basically into two areas. So one is the external things where people can see, people can feel it, and those are the objective materialistic things, like, you know, how much road you're building, is your economic life better, how much income you're making. And the other half is mainly focused on the things which are not visible, and therefore the conventional economic measurements will miss all those things. So these are cultural vitality. I think, Fred, you pointed to the fact in terms of experience, you know, what people value more in their life. Is the relationship in your community, and is the support that you get when you're in trouble. And for example, one of the questionnaires says that how many people can you call on when you are in trouble, whether it's a medical emergency or whether it's a death in a family. And then we tally how many people can you mention. I think most of the time we see that they can, in fact, call the whole village. So that's, you know, if there's 100 people, then everybody feels comfortable in just calling up anybody, shouting, or maybe now through their cell phone. Whereas I think in the urban area, probably the number of people that you can immediately call may be limited to 4 or 5. So there's a direct correlation on actually some of the things which are not captured by conventional measurement. Yeah. So that's how we focus on the half of the measurements are on these kinds of things like the social support, the community vitality, how much sleep you're getting. And yes, I mean, this is none of the government and policy business, but at the same time, I think it is our responsibility to guide people who are willing to see what is the, you know, how much time do you need to sleep in a day, which is the balance between work and work life, and then also trying to lead a healthy lifestyle.
Let's revisit. Let's revisit that in a moment. We have a caller back on the line. I'd like to give them an opportunity. So let me, Jeremy, are you there? And I apologize, we dropped you before somehow.
That's okay. I thought it might be because the topic I wanted to discuss was kind of a counterpoint to Bhutan's gross domestic happiness, which I've been obsessed with since I heard about it years ago. And I mentioned to my grandmother that I was going to move to Bhutan. And she opened my eyes to the refugee crisis that took place and the forced expulsion of refugees. And I still am obsessed with Bhutan and would love to live there. But I did want to offer the counterpoint that it's not a paradise of happiness. And I appreciate what they're doing. But there is, as there is in every country, a history of imperfection, I'll say.
Okay.
I think I think that's a very important point that you raised. And I was saying that we don't claim to be the happiest nation on earth. I think what we have done is we have, to some extent, tried to perfect the policy at the national level. We are the only nation in the world who has elevated the well-being of the citizens at the policy level, and not only just at the community level. And so I think that does require us to sacrifice a lot in terms of, say, cutting down the trees versus, you know, expanding your agricultural land or developing your manufacturing base versus keeping the environmental pristine. So I think that's something which requires a huge sacrifice for every policymaker. And I think to the point that you mentioned about refugee is, this is, of course, a long story, but I do appreciate the fact that you have been following that. I think this is something back in the 90s. And I think at this point, for those who are interested, if you look up, you don't have to go far from Bhutan. If you look up in a neighboring small Himalayan kingdom called the Kingdom of Sikkim, which was probably about the size of Bhutan. And back in 1975, what transition the country went through, and the fact that now there is no more country called Sikkim in that area. In fact, it has been annexed by our neighboring countries as well. So I think for me, for now, the easiest way for people to sort of look at the historical context and actually what the problem that you are mentioning would be to look at the situation of Sikkim. And that would throw a lot of light on what actually happened to Bhutan and where Bhutan was at the verge of almost, I would say, an existential crisis. But I think it's, again, our holistic view on the happiness on, and then also on how we can accommodate sort of in our policy of not only the economic, but also in terms of cultural, multi-ethnic city, multi-religious, and the whole theory and notion of coexistence. And I think we have been doing fairly well from that point of view. But I do agree that there's always areas of improvement. There's always some things we can learn. And the exact context of Bhutan cannot be exported or shared with any other country because Bhutan is Bhutan. I mean, you have to look at the altitude, you have to look at the air, you have to look at the social fabric. So therefore, I think we have to be very careful in terms of saying, oh, we can learn Bhutan's happiness. We can import or export that. But at the same time, I find it extremely gratifying that there are so many things that we can learn from each other. And that's actually what I'm doing exactly with the Institute of Happiness here. Yeah.
Jeremy, thanks very much for the call. And it's a topic that we can't ignore and we shouldn't ignore when those kind of things have happened.
Yeah. Thank
Great,
you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think I want to follow up to Jeremy's comment. And I need to say that my experience when I was in Bhutan is that people are very humble. And I was fortunate enough that the Kinga arranged for us to have an opportunity to meet the Prime Minister and make a presentation before the Secretary of the National Land Commission and the staff regarding environmental issues and dispute resolution and land use and what we do in Canada and the United States. And I will say that everyone that I met, every policymaker I met, people in Bhutan were acknowledged that they were not perfect, that they had room, and they wanted to make things better. And I don't think any one particular person said, we have the answer here. But I think what they were very humble in saying, we know we have room to improve. And can you know, what do you have to offer us to help us improve? But we certainly, I think the important thing is that I believe that they're on a course and they certainly are serving as a model in which the rest of the world can learn.
Yeah. Kinga, I guess tied to some extent, but to Jeremy's concerns and some of my concerns, we don't see many societies, if any societies now in the world, that do not have an underserved population, a destitute population, and I mean you cannot go anywhere in the United States on any given day and not see a homeless person somewhere who is not doing well. Is this a problem in Bhutan, and how does it get addressed?
Oh, yeah, I mean, we are basically, from the UN definition, we are one of the least developing countries, so which means we are a poor country. But the thing is, again, as I said, that definition was by how much dollar you're earning in a day. So I think when you look at that, if it's defined as $3 a day, 5-6 years ago, I think we are primarily the agriculture form, subsistence farming, and agriculture is a big component of the country's economy, and that doesn't get reflected in your daily earnings. So I think when you look at again the measurement of the poverty rate, yes, we were a poor country. But now we are looking at a figure which is less than poverty rate, which is now less than 5%. So which is really one of the, I think, one of the, say, accelerated development and improvement that we have made over the last decades. And now we are graduating into the middle-income country. But in as far as poor, I think the kind of homeless, people that you look at, or people who don't have enough to eat, and who have people who have to be out on the street begging for alms. I think, Doreen, did you have any of those experiences when you went around? I'm not saying we don't have poor people; we do have poor people, but I think homeless, very very few. I can almost count on my fingertips, and those are the people I think primarily. Not because they don't have family, but I think we also do have people with mental health issues. And for some of our colleagues who do have mental health issues, they will not stay with their family and they will be just wandering about. So we do have some of those. But otherwise, I think the, for now at least, the family, extensive family network is very strong. And then also it becomes a social stigma issue, I think. If you have one of your family members who is out on the street, I mean, everybody takes that as a very, very serious issue. Yeah. So they make sure that you are there to take care of your family member, whoever is not doing well.
Yeah, you know, I want to follow up with that. And I traveled in the rural areas. I was in the cities. And I have to say, I did not see one homeless people. And I walked throughout the cities. I mean, there certainly were areas where I would say blighted areas. And I believe that the country's trying, they're actually building new towns in Bhutan and relocating people to these new towns. I saw that there's a great deal of construction going on. I did not see any homeless people throughout. Now, if I walk anywhere on the Central Coast, I see homeless. If I walk any place in the United States, I see homeless. And I don't want to get off on that, where we have gross national product here.
Yeah.
And the number of homeless, I just participated in a survey on it. I did not see that in Bhutan at all. And one of the things we talk about, mental health problem, they do have free health care there. And they do have a very strong family system in Bhutan. Mm-hmm. So, no, that is not an issue. No.
Yeah. And actually, Doreen, you bring up, and when you talk about strong family ties,
yes,
too, I think we, in most of the United States and a lot of the Western world, the concept of multi-generational households pretty much doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. I mean, our grandparents were around more than grandparents are now, as far as the home situation, and a lot of that, I believe, had to do with a more agrarian society, as we've evolved away from an agrarian society. Is extended family, Kinga, is an extended family environment looked at as a desire to reinforce for a more a stronger well-being of your people?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think the extended family concept is still very strong and prevalent, even in the urban areas. And now, of course, increasingly, we do have among the educated population where people are focusing on the nuclear family as well. But otherwise, as I was saying, that even if somebody is unemployed, chances are that he or she is not going hungry or not even making sometimes genuine effort to really look for jobs. And then in Bhutan, I think we have a paradox where sometimes that a lot of now college graduates are complaining about not getting a job. But the reality is they don't want to do certain jobs and they're not ready to do some jobs which they're not, they feel it's below their education level and so on. And I think one of the reasons why they can afford to do that is, again, because of the extended family network. Because even if you're in the urban area, You can always go to your uncle's house or your aunt's place or your relative's place, and you're always welcome there to stay with them. And then the other thing is, I think the contribution that the grandparents make now to even the nuclear family where both the husband and the wife they are working. So they would have kids, so to drop the kids to the school, pick them up, and, you know, tend to the kids at home, who would you best have? I think the best, best nannies will be your grandparents. And I think Bhutan, that role is automatically assumed by the grandparents as soon as their kids get married and start having kids. So a lot of times, I mean, even for my daughters, they have been growing up more with my wife's mother than us, because we have been sort of in a way busy working. So yeah, the extended family concept is very, very strong and prevalent in Bhutan.
Yeah, what is the what's the basis of higher education in Bhutan? Do I mean, you traveled out of the country for a lot of your education and are still doing so? Is there a university system within the country? I mean, there's not that many people to support a major infrastructure of university. Is there the tendency to go abroad?
Well, we have, education, there has been a big thrust. So the primary education enrollment is 100% for every kid who is 6 years old and elder. And then the gross enrollment ratio from, say, your high school towards university is about 10 to 15%. So I mean, given Bhutan's population, the absolute number may be small, but the higher education is something which, again, through the happiness policy of free education, we are providing to as many kids as possible. So we have one university called the Royal University of Bhutan, 12 colleges, so typical of any other university here in U.S. with different streams in engineering, medical, and then also humanities, arts, and so on. So, yes, we do have kids now. Increasingly, literacy rate is very high, and our elementary education system starts with English as the main medium of instruction, because for us, I think, as a small country, it would be extremely difficult for us to translate everything into Bhutanese. So therefore, I think it's easier for us. This is one of the policy decisions that our policymakers 30, 40 years have taken up, and is serving us quite well. So yeah, so education is, even culturally, we have a saying that a word of wisdom and education knowledge is worth far more than 100 kilograms of gold. So that is the value system that Bhutanese society we attach to education. And as a matter of fact, even in the villages, we hear stories about how some simple farmer parents would sell their cows or sell their even inheritance of land and then try to send their kids to college for education. As far as kids going out, I think, yes, now, with some middle-income family doing fairly well, and also with the opportunities of scholarship and financing provided. I mean, in my family, all of us are heavily dependent on financial aid, including myself and my kids. So I mean, yes, I think there's so much of opportunity even to go abroad and go outside. But education does remain one of the key focus areas for policymakers in Bhutan. At the same time, education is one of the biggest challenges in terms of being able to deliver the quality we need and the skills that that the economy needs. I think that is still now a big, big challenge in Bhutan.
Well, as we look at this and look at that being a very desirable social structure and society, do you find? I mean, you are bordered by one of what is considered, from a political standpoint and a social standpoint, one of the most repressive countries in the world. Do you experience people who are attempting to immigrate to Bhutan? Do you have a amount of traffic that people who are maybe just trying to get out of China and look at a friendly environment with a positive attitude as a as a conduit, if you will, to go someplace else.
Right. I think, Fred, I think you sort of answered. I didn't want to elongate the explanation to Jeremy's question. I think you exactly answered his question. Yes, that is what exactly happened, because a lot of people saw the free healthcare, free education system, and this whole fertile area in Bhutan, and a lot of people were immigrating into Bhutan from neighboring countries. And that's when we had this huge problem, because a country which with a population of just around 500,000, now you have an immigrant which is numbering more than the original population in the country, where do you end up? So exactly, yes. I think this is one of the problems that not only we have in a trickle-down thing, but we really did have a huge, huge problem back 20, 30 years ago.
Okay. You did. So back to the educational issue, you said that all of the youth in Bhutan are basically taught English as their primary school language?
That's correct.
Okay. So, but is the cultural history of your native language still reinforced for basically cultural purposes?
Oh, I mean, not only cultural, but also as the whole focus that we are providing in terms of cultural and community vitality has got a very strong endorsement, and then also a deliberate effort on everyone's part to keep our language, which is part of the culture, alive. So, for instance, I mean, Doreen has seen every office that government office that you go to in Bhutan, every public place, we have to make sure that we wear our national dress, because that's a source of pride and also something that differentiates us from so many other culture and so many other countries. And so at even in writing, the official language, one we use English, but now it's increasingly our own Dzongkha, which is called the national language, is called the Dzongkha. So that language is spoken in the parliament, and Dzongkha is a language which is taught in the schools together with English. So, I mean, as far as when you are in Bhutan, even the entertainment industry, the movie industry, this has been something which I think was a test for us, because we have been inundated with, let's say, the two biggest movie industries in the world, Hollywood, popular Hollywood movies and popular Bollywood movies from India. And when I was growing up, I mean, those were the entertainment for us. Even as kids, we used to sort of really run away from boarding school to watch these movies. But now, come this present day, the cinema halls and movie theaters in Bhutan, they're all playing Bhutanese movies, who are wearing national dress, who are singing Bhutanese songs, and of course, some of the lyrics, and these are always copied from Hollywood and Bollywood. So to your point, I feel that one is from the policy effort, but the other one is also, I think, genuinely people do realize the value of preserving your own culture and tradition, and that the movie industry was a very, very prime example, case in point, because that's something which is totally within the private domain.
Yeah. Before we run out of time, I want to go back and revisit Doreen talked about the concept of being a carbon negative country. Can you reiterate on that a little bit from a planner's standpoint about how that addresses the needs of a community and the needs of the world?
Yeah, I think typically what you find is that most countries put more carbon dioxide into the air, which then creates the greenhouse gas effect. And what Bhutan has done is actually their carbon footprint is less than neutral. It is actually negative. And they're the only country in the world that's doing that. And they currently have 70% of their country that's forested, and in their constitution they do not want to go below, I believe it's 60%. Is that correct, Kinga?
Yes. So right now we are somewhere between 70 to 75%.
Okay, 70 to 75%. So I don't know if you want to expand on the carbon negative position.
I mean, Doreen, I think you got it exactly right. Okay. So the you know, we are acting as a carbon sink. And in reality, is when Doreen must have realized it, when you travel in Bhutan, the whole country actually is like a protected national park. So 60 to 70% of the nation, you cannot do any development. So from planning perspective, I think it's got to be one of the biggest challenges, because if you want to develop certain area, but you cannot build roads, you cannot cut down the trees. So that's what we have been trying to do. And then also any proposal, whether at national level or whatever, we have to pass it through the happiness lens, so which looks at, you know, whether what is the negative impact on the environment. If something, if it is like a manufacturing industry, then we don't build it in Bhutan at all. So because we are saying this is against the happiness policy.
Yeah.
So therefore, I think there is a natural selection process through the policy where we don't encourage any one of these. And then majority of our export is, again, hydropower, which is a renewable energy source. And then the other one is for us is the tourism, which is, again, non-polluting in the traditional sense. So, yes, so we are you know, very, very mindful and careful in terms of what activities we
Would you reiterate again? So your primary means of generating power in the country is
hydropower. Yeah.
Okay, and that's as long as you have an adequate power source to handle your population. Is your population growing or is it reasonably stable?
The population is reasonably stable, 650,000. So, I mean, even if you grow exponentially, we are not looking at a huge population explosion. And right now, we export 85% of what we produce in terms of energy. So, I mean, that's part of having this huge river basin in Bhutan. And these are perennial streams which are fed by the snow from the Himalayan mountain tops. Mm-hmm. So in a way, we are blessed with these resources which we are using to basically keep ourselves carbon negative.
Yeah. We're down to just a few more minutes. And as I told everyone before, I've told guests before, and we mentioned to you before you're on the program, I like to try and get out of the way to give you a couple of minutes to make sure that we don't forget something that you think is very important here. So, Kinga, why don't you go ahead and start and make sure there's not some part of this this story and this picture that we've lost track of.
Okay, thanks. I think the main thing about the GNH and Bhutan is that we have to make sure that people understand that this is a very unique and contextual vision in Bhutan and from Bhutan. So therefore, we don't claim that we have perfected the art of happiness policy. We are still in the learning process. But as I said, we have made this effort just in some simple things like environment, to keep it pristine, to have 60% of the forest coverage, and for the population to make sure that they don't have to worry about their health care, that they don't have to worry about their education. Everybody has got a fair chance in making it to the middle class and beyond if you are hardworking. At the same time, I think the relationship and the value in the community, we pay a lot of attention to that, and increasingly becoming challenging with all the technology and all the developments in the world. But that's something I think you have to be careful about. And also, I think sometimes we tend to take happiness very lightly. So in Bhutan, we say it's a very serious matter for us. That's why we raise it at the national level. And I think finally, what I just wanted to sort of share with all our friends is that this is a two-way learning process. What we can offer from Bhutan by the vision of our fourth king, and then also with the policy instruments that we are using, some of the data, some of the progresses we have made, we are willing to share. And we would also like to learn from some of the things that has been happening here in California and also here on the East Coast. And as a matter of fact, we are organizing what we call the GOES Happiness, National Happiness Conference on April 13th of 2019 here at the Harvard Divinity School. And Doreen is going to be here. We have lined up some excellent speakers, and is going to share everything ranging from how to govern for happiness to how do you measure it to what the Happiness Center at the Harvard School of Public Health is doing and what some of the professors are doing on the psychology part, what some of the people are doing in MIT on technology and AI. So I feel that even though it's a very, very century-old concept that Bhutan has sort of been trailblazing through, we are getting a lot of interest and allies even from our friends here in the U.S. So I'm very happy to share with this and hopefully see a lot of you in Cambridge on April 13, 2019.
Okay. Thank you, Kinga.
Kinga, I look forward to seeing you in April. And I just want to say that, again, my experience with the people in Bhutan and, of course, with Kinga is that Bhutan has an awful lot to offer us with their organic farming, with their climate change examples, their energy, their economy, but also that they're open to saying that they certainly can learn from us. And I think we certainly can learn from them. And I've joked with Kinga that I think that they're a country that should become a think tank, basically, as we have learning institutions, they can just become a country of a think tank, and that can be part of their economic program. And I'd like to see this as a dialogue, just something that we can all start talking about, Fred.
Yeah. And If you have any interest in pursuing this topic, if you want to send an email to voices@kcbx.org, we can pass it on to Kinga or Darlene, because it's a process that Darlene would like to have explored more on the Central Coast and looked at as in a healthy standpoint from that standpoint. And Kinga, thank you very much also. Want to remind you folks that next week Chris Kington Barker will be with you, and she's going to look at the impact of housing policy on the Central Coast. The San Luis Obispo Tribune reported this week that San Luis Obispo County is the seventh least affordable place to buy a home in the entire United States, and that we have a serious housing crisis, of course. Her guest next week will be James Worsley, who's a regional planning division chief at SLOCOG, that's the San Luis Obispo Council of Government, and Michael Hopkins, who is Hopkins Tucker, who is the policy analyst for housing at the People's Self-Help Housing Organization, and they're going to discuss how housing policy affects where we are in the Central Coast and the well-being of our life, and that'll be their discussion next week. So join Chris here, and I want to remind you again that this is a project of Action for Healthy Communities. You can look at our report on actionslo.org. You can contact us at voices@kcbx.org, or you can also call us at 805-543-2323. And thanks again to KCBX Public Radio for partnering with us to have the environment to do this. Thank you, Doreen Liberto, for being part of the show today, and Kinga Tsaring. I appreciate you spending the time on the phone with us, and it's fascinating what you're doing, and I appreciate being part of the discussion. Thank you for joining us. This has been Central Coast Voices.